Okay, so thank you for inviting me. If you can't hear very well, you might want to move to the front because I do tend to speak softly, but I'll try my best. So today I've been invited to come to talk about Buddhism and meditation. Which is, I guess, kind of a break from what normally goes on in this building. This is a science building, no? But Buddhism is what something we consider to be a science. The practice of meditation we consider to be scientific. And I think the scientific community here in general might have a bit of a problem with that. So I'd like to explain why we consider and how we consider and how we might consider Buddhism and Buddhist meditation to be scientific. As it relates to meditation, how is Buddhism a scientific undertaking? It's because it's for the purpose of cultivating knowledge, understanding, which is the primary basis of science, right? The meaning of science is to know, to gain knowledge. With the idea that when you come to know something about a topic, when you gain knowledge about something, you gain some sort of a power over it. And so, for the most part, the human race has focused on the material world and the material sciences, gaining an understanding of how the physical realm works. And within the physical realm, we've therefore worked out techniques and methods, or the scientific method. That allows us to gain knowledge about the natural world, about the physical world. And to separate, for example, knowledge from belief, from supposition, from falsehood. So we're able to disprove claims about the natural world as well. We're able to change people's views on things like whether the world is flat or whether the universe revolves around the earth, whether the atom is the smallest, is indivisible, is an indivisible entity, and so on. And all of these concepts play a large part in Buddhism, and yet scientists tend to shy away from any idea of personal understanding because it doesn't fit with the scientific model. In the context of the natural or the material world, subjective experience is, with good reason, trivialized as anecdotal or subjective. So until you can prove it with third-person impersonal instruments, there's no means by which you could be taken seriously, or you wouldn't be taken seriously by material scientists. It's important because obviously, otherwise, someone could claim something to be the nature of reality, and you couldn't disprove them. Their claim doesn't have a, what do you call, the element of falsifiability, right? There's no test you could make to prove whether that person was telling the truth or was telling a lie or was just being deluded. So there's a sense that personal experience can't be trusted to make claims about the natural world, about reality, about the universe. But really it's because it's a mistake of context. When you're talking about the external world, then it may be true that personal experience is unreliable or doesn't have much to say about, doesn't have anything to add or to give to the conversation. And so it's useless, it's not useful. And that's really the point, is because science at its best is something that is useful. It's got a power to it because you can say to a great level of certainty whether something is true or false through experimentation and research. But that's also where Buddhism makes a claim to be scientific in its own right, because meditation may not be useful in helping you to understand the nature of the atom or how to create graphene sheets or so on. But it does have something to say about the mind. And whether or not the results that are gained from meditation are true or simply subjective or whatever label you want to give them, the claim that we make is that they're useful. One, they're knowledge-based. So it's based on gaining an understanding of how your mind and your experience works that is in fact reproducible by you. So within the context of your own mind, reproducible. And reproducible to the point that it creates a knowledge similar to scientific knowledge, that, you know, 1,000 times I've seen my mind do the same thing, so it doesn't really matter whether it's ultimately true or false. It, for all intents and purposes, this is the truth. And this is a realization that comes. It's not an intellectual thing. Having seen something happen again and again and again, you start to change your habits based on that. So based on, for example, suffering, happiness, goodness, and corruption in the mind. So, like addiction, you'll be able to see the cycle of addiction, and you see, well, what does addiction lead me to? What does it do for me? Fear and aversion, anxiety. You're able to see through the meditation what these do to your mind. You're able to see why you are dissatisfied with life. Why are you? Why do you have stress in your life? Why do you suffer in your life? And so, it's incredibly useful. Obviously, this is something that I think needs very little stressing, because in the world, in the modern world, there's now become a great appreciation for the benefits of meditation. All I wanted to stress is the idea that it is considered to be scientific, in the sense that how, according to Buddhism, how you bring about the benefit isn't simply through relaxation, isn't simply through escapism, escaping your problems, isn't a vacation from your troubles. And this is important because this is a misunderstanding a lot of people have about meditation. We tend to have this idea that meditation should be peaceful and calm and a means to get away from your problems. This isn't how the Buddha envisioned meditation at all. He recognized such meditations, he even taught them as a means of preparing the mind, because when your mind is calm, obviously you can do much more with it. It's much more pliant and much more amenable to the cultivation of insight, of understanding. Just like water, if water is all muddy or murky or turbid, boiling and so on, you can't see what's in it. You have to wait until it settles. And so there's a benefit to the tranquility, but it's not the point. The point is to be able to understand, to gain an understanding of how your mind works. And so there's a claim that it's not random or chaotic or subjective in the sense of having free will. And I think that's maybe where the problem lies, is we have this subconscious sort of prejudice towards the idea of the mind being outside of the realm of science in terms of being somehow associated with free will. So meaning there would be no rules in the mind, and you could never come up with scientific statements about the working of the mind, which is absolutely not true. And I think with a little, if you put a little thought into it, you can see how that, even science is showing how that's not true. And but there's still this idea somehow that the mind is subjective, which of course shouldn't be. Because on the other hand, most scientists want to say that it's just an epiphenomenon of the brain. The mind is simply a byproduct of the brain, which they would say the brain is completely deterministic, which is the other extreme. But the truth is, as you can see, and if you even reflect upon how addiction therapy, addiction research has gone, and how modern neuroscience has come to show, that the mind does work according to quite strict and orderly rules and laws of nature. So that's what we try to do in meditation. I'm thinking that this is a little bit of a surprise for some people, that or it's a little unfamiliar, and it should be, because our understanding of, as I said, of meditation is usually just in terms of relaxation. So what we try to do in Buddhism is go the next step and cultivate understanding through the meditation practice. And that's what I'd like to focus on today. Try to give you some basic tools by which you could, if you so choose, cultivate some understanding about how your mind works. So some basic principles about what that sort of technique would have to look like. The idea would be to get yourself as objective as possible, obviously. This is the problem, is if you're doing the observing, you can't set up a double blind or any kind of peer review. You're relying completely on your observation of the experience. Again, it's not terribly important, because that's the realm in which we're dealing. We're dealing with our own mind, so it's okay. But still, we can, as a result, very easily, through wrong practice, we could very easily corrupt our own minds or create problems for ourselves. And so we want to be objective when we practice. So we need some kind of technique to allow us to observe our minds and our experience objectively. And this is the technique that I'm going to share with you. The technique that we teach, it's the technique that the Buddha taught. So this is 2,500 years old. It's a religious teaching. And yet, we'll explain it clearly, so you can hopefully see that it's quite objective and could maybe say timeless in the sense that it has nothing really to do with the ancient world or Asia or Buddhism or any specific group or realm. No. So somehow universal and directly related to the workings of the mind. We take it as a premise that the mind takes one object at a time. So there's an awareness, this is the consciousness, and there is the experience, which I think is called a qualia or something, a scientific term, for an experience. And when an experience occurs, the normal process is for the mind to react. It experiences, for example, seeing. So from the point of view of the mind, there's no process going on in the brain, there's an experience of seeing. From a first person point of view, that's what really exists. So you could say that's the base phenomenon. You have an experience of seeing. And that's fine. There would be no, we wouldn't have any of the problems that we have in life if that's all there was. If there was just seeing and just hearing, just smelling, tasting, feeling, even just thinking. Thoughts themselves can't hurt you. They can't cause problems. And so that it's not a problem that we have to solve. But then something else happens. I see two things, and I distinguish between them. So the color's different, the texture's different, the position is different, so on. But still, no real problem. I'm able to distinguish. It's actually quite a useful skill, the ability to distinguish between two experiences as being different. Being the same is also useful. So if I've seen a cup before, and then I see this cup, I know that it's a cup. That's useful, because if not, if I didn't have that skill, I wouldn't know what this was for, why someone came and placed this in front of me. Maybe it's just for decoration, but because I recognize that's similar to something I've seen before, I know that it's what its purpose is. So still a very useful thing, and really not a cause, not something we have to figure out. But then we start to get into trouble, because maybe I've tasted, I recognize that this one's water and I recognize that this one's mango. And I've tasted them both before. And while the water maybe provided some sort of refreshment, the mango stimulated something in my brain that cultivated a sense of pleasure, right? Some kind of chemicals going off in my brain and creating some kind of mental pleasure that this was something good based on the sugar or based on the flavor and so on. And so I have a memory that this one was good. As a result of that, another part of my brain kicks in and starts telling me that I should take it. It starts pulling me towards the mango. So I'm no longer objective. I'm now kind of forgotten about the water, because as long as the mango's there, the water's not able to take up a significant place in my mind. I've become, I could say, somewhat obsessed with the mango, to the extent that I might even perform immoral acts to get it. No, to extremes, it cultivates addiction and starts to cause a problem for me. No. Maybe this isn't my drink. Maybe this was someone else left it here and someone brought water for me. But in order to stop myself, I have to actually invoke another part of my mind, this repression aspect, to repress my desire for it. Or else naturally, if I was a monkey or any number of animals, I would just go and take what I want. But we have some kind of ability in our minds to stop that. So there's processes in the mind. The mind is actually quite complex, but orderly. It's going to happen like that all the time. It's not going to be different. And in fact, as research, addiction research has shown, the more I get the mango and enjoy it and file that away in my mind, the stronger it gets. It becomes a real addiction. I mean, in the case of mango juice, it's probably not that dangerous. It just means I'm going to be partial towards it. And it creates a little bit of suffering when I only get water. If I only got water, I'd be thinking about the mango juice. And we can extrapolate this. These basic processes are a part of everything we do. And they make up the building blocks of all the real problems in our lives. True addiction, phobias, neuroses, obsessive compulsive disorder. All of these mental conditions are based on the building blocks of experience and the cultivation of certain types of experience. Now, they of course have a basis in the brain and the body as well, and even food. Yes, obviously there's something in the mango juice that the body likes as well and cultivates that, but ultimately, the claim is, ultimately the mind determines the reaction to the experience. So it may be that a certain substance cultivates pleasure in the body, cultivates a pleasurable stimulus in the body, but the claim is that it's still ultimately up to the mind to react to it. Pain, for example. The common understanding of pain is that it's a bad thing. It's unpleasant. It's something that in and of itself creates suffering for the mind. That if you're in pain, it's not a scientific dogma, but it's a belief that we hold, it's a general sense that we have, that if you have pain, it's bad. And yet, if you think about it, there are cases where you could have pain and not be bothered by it. You could be exercising, for example, and you could even feel good about the pain. In more extreme cases, sadomasochism, people actually enjoy the feeling. And this is possible because pain is really just another sensation. And so we have claims like this and a general sense that understanding has a huge influence on our reactions. So for example, you stub your foot on the table and it causes pain. And you get angry. If you know who put the table there, or who you know, you think, why did they make this table with the legs like that? Then you'll get angry at those people. But sometimes you'll just get angry at the table. And so, usually we're able to justify it and say, you know, really that person, they were the reason. And so we feel somehow that there's a logic behind our anger. There's no logic behind getting angry at the table. And in fact, there's no logic at getting angry at anyone, even if they hit you in the face or call you nasty names. Why? Because anger is actually a cause for suffering. Anger is something that debilitates you, that makes you incapable of rational judgment. It's something that affects you negatively, causes suffering. And so, when you know that, if you can teach yourself that, then you'll find you won't be getting angry at the table or at anyone. You won't be as likely to get angry about things. Once you experience and teach yourself, once you observe again and again and again how anger is actually causing physical and mental pain for you, then you're less likely to get angry in the future. And the claim that we make is that this works in all cases regarding happiness and suffering, that true happiness and suffering are dependent on, ultimately dependent on ignorance and understanding. So this is why we consider Buddhist meditation to be an ultimately scientific endeavor, because it has to do with knowledge. Once you understand something, you have power over it. This is true with the mind. Once you understand how the mind works, you're able to keep yourself from getting upset and reacting to those things that would normally cause you suffering. So, how do we do? What is the technique by which we do this? We have this catchphrase that a lot of people may have heard of in Buddhist meditation called mindfulness. It's not the best, most descriptive word to use, but it does give you a sense of what we're trying to accomplish, some kind of observation. That through some sort of observation of our experience, we can cultivate understanding, which is correct. This is how we do it. But the real meaning behind the word mindfulness, or the word that we translate as mindfulness, is actually to remind yourself. It's a technique for cultivating objectivity, so that whatever you experience, you just experience it without reacting to it. Because by the time you've gotten upset about something, or you've judged that the mango juice is better and the water is inferior, you're no longer able to watch your mind. You're no longer able to see and to observe how your mind works, because your whole focus is on getting the mango juice. And so the meditation practice is to break that chain, is to watch our own minds, to observe our own minds, and to record, to note what's occurring in the mind, with this idea of noting. And if you're able to note everything that occurs and repeatedly the processes in the mind, you'll slowly catch the patterns. And it's not going to be intellectual, really, because you're experiencing it. You'll say, oh, that's painful for me. Oh, that's painful. Again, it's painful. And eventually you become disinclined to, your mind naturally becomes disinclined to perform the same action. So, simple technique. For example, when you see something, you would try to label it as seeing. Just remind yourself, seeing. So your mind cultivates the awareness of seeing. You try to cultivate on top of that an objectivity that keeps you simply aware of the seeing, not liking or disliking the experience. If you get on to liking something, to you recognize that that's mango, you would recognize that as knowing that something is different from something else. If you like it, note to yourself liking. It's no longer in the juice, but now it's in your mind. And so, but then you'd watch the liking, because at every step you want to see what comes next. What does that do? So you want to be able to, you want to be there watching it. And so we have this simple technique of kind of like a mantra, except it has nothing to do with religion or God or the divine in any way. It's just a reminder for us that keeps our mind focused on the experience. So you might be sitting here and a thought arises. Thoughts about home or thoughts about work or school. And often these thoughts can be a cause for stress, can be a cause for worry, can be a cause for desire, thinking about dinner. And in many instances can impede your life, can get in the way of your life, cause problems for you. So here you want to sit and listen to a lecture. Suppose you're in class and you're trying to listen, but your mind won't obey. So a very simple example is in terms of your abilities in school, for example. A person who practices meditation, because they're able to observe the experience without getting carried away by it. So when you have these thoughts and you say to yourself, you catch yourself, you're alert, and you catch yourself and say thinking, are aware that it's just a thought, and instead of getting caught up in the thought and carried away, then you're able to focus on what's going on. When I was in school and I started meditating, went back to school, and I was getting A pluses across the board because it was just quite easy. The exams were not, you know, there was no stress involved with the classes or the exams because it becomes quite ordinary. The experience is no longer has a stress attached to it. You're no longer judging the experience or getting caught up in the experience. And you're no longer getting distracted by other experience. So I guess what I'd like to do is just lead you all through a sort of a guided meditation, give you a chance to try this technique and see what you think. I know oftentimes when you hear it, it sounds kind of silly, meaningless, uninspiring. I hope not. I mean, I hope some of what I've said makes sense and that it's, you get the idea that this is somehow a scientific exploration. And maybe that sounds kind of dry and onerous in the sense that you've been doing this all day and more science, but I assure you it's quite different and it's quite more rewarding on a personal level. It brightens your mind. If you can practice what I'm going to show you, your mind will be clear and bright and you'll find yourself peaceful, and you find all of the judgments and that would lead you to feel that something was onerous or boring and so on, disappearing. So, without further ado, let's everyone close your eyes. You don't have to sit in any particular way. Close your eyes, get comfortable, maybe put your hands on your lap. One hand on, if you want to be like the traditional way, is to put one hand on top of the other, palms up. And we're just going to start to remind ourselves of absolutely everything that occurs. Remind ourselves in the sense, once we experience it, we're going to repeat the knowledge. So seeing is just seeing. Once we see something, we tell ourselves that's just seeing, instead of letting our mind say that's good, that's bad. When you think something, that's just thinking. Instead of letting your mind get carried away by it, keep your mind focused on the essence of it. Right? Because once you get caught up in thinking, then it's so many other things. It's a problem, or it's a plan, or it's a fantasy. It's a whole other world, all of which isn't really real, isn't a part of what's really going on. What's really going on is just thinking. Now, the way we begin, because obviously this is going to be a difficult undertaking to just catch everything and suddenly make sense of the chaos of our mind. To begin, we start with the body. We don't even begin with the mind. We start by focusing on the body with the understanding that the mind's not going to go anywhere but the body. Wherever we focus, our mind's going to go along, obviously. And so we'll get to indirectly study the mind. As we focus on the body, our mind's going to pull us away. It's going to distract us, take away our attention, and so then we'll get to see how the mind reacts to simple experience. But if we start with the mind, there's the difficulty of finding it and figuring out where it is and chasing it. We don't need to do that. We'll stay focused on the body and then watch when the mind does its tricks. So focusing on the body, one thing you can do is just focus on the sitting posture. So we can start that just in your mind when you feel that you're sitting, all of the tension in the back or the pressure underneath you, your feet on the floor, your legs tense, any of the feelings that you have for sitting. Once you get a sense that this is a sitting posture, you can just say to yourself, sitting. And so you can repeat it like a mantra, sitting, sitting, sitting. Just something to keep you objective, observing the experience. Another technique, one that we usually recommend that I'd like you to try, is to focus on your stomach, the breath. When the breath comes into the body, if your body is relaxed, you should be able to sense a rising and a falling of the abdomen. When the breath comes into the body, the abdomen will rise. When the breath goes out of the body, the abdomen will fall. And so we just focus on this, saying to ourselves, rising, falling, rising, falling. If you can't feel it, you can put your hand on your stomach. Try and get a sense, because in the beginning it's unfamiliar, and if you have a high stress level, you find maybe it's more in your chest. But once you get comfortable and relaxed, you should find that the abdomen does rise and fall. So we start by focusing on this. And we're not trying to condition the breathing, condition the experience. Even though in the beginning you'll find this is the tendency, the mind wants to control. That's fine, that's part of what we're trying to learn about ourselves, that we like to control things. We're trying to see how much suffering is caused by trying to control things, which you should see. But it's not the goal of the meditation. And so don't actively try to force the breath to be deep or clear. It's not clear, just put your hand on the stomach. But what you should see after a while, after a short while, is that there's much more going on than just the rising and falling of the abdomen. And so that's where our task really begins. So once something takes our mind away from the observation of the abdomen, then we're going to start to study it. We study it in the same way, just cultivate. Again, we're trying to observe. We're not trying to make theories or ideas or beliefs or anything. We just need our minds in an objective state. So again, we can't just watch because we know our minds are subjective. We have partialities and judgments and even beliefs and views that will cloud our judgment. So again, we need to use this, or we encourage the use of this tool. For example, if you feel pain, if you're sitting and you feel pain, it's not a problem, and it's not considered to be a distraction from the meditation. It's something that we would meditate on, because we want to see how our mind reacts to the pain. Moreover, we want to learn about the pain so that we can see it for what it is and see whether it really is a problem or not. And so we focus on the pain and say to ourselves, pain, pain, pain. Just aware that it's pain and reminding ourselves in order to keep ourselves in an objective state. You'll find it actually works. It may seem odd, an odd practice, but if you try it, you'll see that it really does work. Your mind is objective. Just aware of the pain. In fact, so much so that it is no longer upset by the pain, no longer disturbed by it, no longer suffering from it. And in and of itself, that's an incredible gain. All this study about how to deal with pain, how science tries to find ways for people to cope with or overcome pain. Here we have a way to do it for yourself. If you're good enough at this, you can become so objective about the pain that it no longer bothers you. As it shouldn't, because there's no reason for the mind to get upset. It doesn't help you. It's not like you think or solve problems better when you're in agony. And so we just acknowledge the pain, noting it, until it goes away. Once it's gone, we come back again to the stomach. Or just the body, if you prefer, saying sitting, sitting, or rising, falling. Same goes for if you feel happy. Obviously, happiness isn't a problem for us, but there's a problem with pleasure. When you feel some kind of pleasure, it initiates the addiction cycle, where you eventually become addicted to the pleasure. And that's what you'll find quickly in meditation, is whatever you are addicted to, even slightly, it'll come up in meditation. So probably during this session that we're sitting here, you'll find various things that you normally desire and indulge in your life, coming back to you, wanting them, desiring these things. And so, in a basic sense, this is, at the very least, it's taking us away from our meditation. In order to stop that, we have to become objective about the happiness. So again, we say to ourselves, happy, happy. Same goes for if you just feel calm, say to yourself, calm, calm, calm. Just recognize it for what it is and keep an objective mind about it. The next distraction that comes up that is equally important for us to study and understand is the mind, the thoughts. Our thoughts about the past, the future, good thoughts, bad thoughts, objective thoughts, judgmental thoughts. All kinds of thinking. That we normally think we rely on to solve our problems, but actually most of the time just serve to get in our way and keep us from a clarity of mind. When they create this chaos in our minds that makes us suffer. That leads to stress and clinging and dissatisfaction and all sorts of problems. Because we're not clearly aware of the experience. We don't have the understanding about it. If someone hurts you, you tend to obsess over the thoughts. If someone says something you don't agree with, you'll obsess over an argument about it. If you want something, you'll obsess over how to get it and so on. And the obsession doesn't help. The obsession is a product of the thinking, product of subjective thinking. So we cultivate an objectivity, and this helps to create understanding that changes that, so that we think only thoughts, and we don't become obsessed with them. We're not trying to stop ourselves from thinking. That's not the point of meditation. We're trying to understand the thoughts as thoughts. Nothing more, nothing less. So again, we remind ourselves, thinking, thinking. Just cultivating this clarity of mind that says this is thinking. And once the thought's gone, we just come back again to the body, wait for the next interruption. Now already you should be learning a few things about how your mind works. Mostly in the beginning what we learn is how chaotic the mind is, how unamenable the mind is to this sort of activity. It's not cooperating. For many people, beginning to meditate is the most difficult part. This is of course, as it should be, because it's a new activity. It's not something we're comfortable with or accustomed to. It's a new habit. The habit of objectivity should be new to us. If you haven't ever practiced this type of meditation, our minds are so accustomed to subjectivity, to judging things and reacting to experiences, that just being aware of them actually can seem quite unpleasant, as the mind wants to cling, wants to chase, wants to judge, wants to react. but in the interests of science, we have a duty to cultivate this objectivity so we can understand our own minds, and to our own benefit, because we have to agree that that which causes us suffering is only our own reactions and judgments. And so if it were possible not to react, to just experience, to just be, to just let it go, as they say, not get upset when things don't go our way, to not expect things to be a certain way so that we set ourselves up for disappointment. If we were just here and now, in the moment. It's not easy. In the beginning, this is not comfortable. So don't get discouraged just because it seems difficult. It's difficult because it's new. It's a new habit. Our habit is quite different, or normally. But eventually, through this noting process, your mind cultivates the habit of objectivity, and it no longer wants to be judgmental because it sees how much suffering that causes. It sees the benefit of objective impartiality, as having a clear mind and a peaceful mind and a wise and understanding mind. Nonetheless, question still exists, what do we do when the mind becomes partial? So what do you do when you're angry or worried or afraid? How do you deal with that? And actually the answer is just the same as any other aspect of experience. You become objective about it. Because anger may be a problem in terms of causing suffering in the mind, but it's not nearly as much problem as reacting to the anger. And once you react to the anger, then you say and do things that you tend to regret later. Or when you have greed and addiction, you tend to overindulge in things, whether it be food or substances or activities, pastimes, to the extent that they interfere with your life, they interfere with your goals, with your happiness, because they cultivate cycles of addiction that in the end leave you disappointed and wanting more and more, instead of being content with what you have. So, whatever state of mind arises, whether it be a liking or a wanting or disliking or frustration, boredom, worry, sadness, fear, drowsiness when the mind is tired, distraction when the mind is not focused, doubt or confusion when the mind is all muddled. Whatever the state of mind is, we can and should try to cultivate an objective awareness of it as well. And this really gets to the point because it helps us understand these emotions and these states and to see them for what they are. In many cases, cultivating the disinclination to repeat the experience, to cultivate the emotion. So you don't want to be angry once you see how useless it is, how unpleasant it is. You don't want to cling to things when you see how that doesn't make you happier. But most importantly, it creates this objectivity which dispels the experience. So you're actually able to to make the feeling go away. When you say to yourself, wanting, wanting, if you can catch and be objectively aware about the wanting, you find it disappears almost immediately, and you're left with a sense of contentment. If you're angry and you say to yourself, angry, angry, if you can catch the anger up, you find you're no longer angry anymore. If you're bored or afraid or sad, same thing. If you're honest with yourself and truly objective, just by seeing the experience for what it is, all of your subjectivity, all of your partiality disappears, and so the judgment is gone. There's no fuel for the emotion. And as a result, it fades away. If you feel drowsy, you say to yourself, drowsy, drowsy, before you fall asleep. If you feel distracted, unfocused, you can say distracted, distracted, which actually focuses the mind. If you have doubt or confusion, say doubting, doubting, confused, confused, and you're no longer doubting or confused. You now have a state of confidence in the mind. So it really balances out all of these imbalanced states of mind. Creates a sense of clarity, of centeredness. And when the emotions are gone, just come back again to the body. You can apply the technique to anything, any aspect of your experience. If you see something, you can say to yourself, seeing. If you hear something, say to yourself, hearing. This works well if someone's using harsh speech or useless speech, something that you don't want to listen to but would prefer not to get upset about. You can just listen to the sound and say to yourself, hearing, hearing. And you find that rather than getting upset about the sound, you still understand what's being said, but you're no longer judging it. You're like an impartial observer. You find it helps a lot in terms of maintaining harmony under difficult circumstances and keeping peace of mind when you're in a stressful environment. Smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking, all the senses. If it feels too hot in the room, or too hot outside. Once you say to yourself, feeling or hot, you'll find that judgment goes away and you actually feel quite comfortable. Same with cold. When you're standing out in the cold, and where I'm from anyway, when you say to yourself, cold, even the snow you can put up with, and not be disturbed by it. Now, none of this means that you don't react. It just means that you react with wisdom. So when you're standing out in the snow and you figure you're going to get frostbite, it doesn't mean you just stand there until you get frostbite. But you don't get upset. You don't have this debilitating judgment in the mind that actually keeps you from thinking rationally. It makes you act irrationally and makes you reactive, reactionary. You're no longer impartial, you're no longer basing your decisions on wisdom, you're basing them on preference, which isn't nearly as helpful, as beneficial to you. In the West, we like to say, follow your heart. In Thailand, they also say, follow your heart. It's an expression, but it has... In the West, it has this has a positive connotation. It has the opposite connotation in Thailand. Following your heart is a bad thing. Because there's the understanding that, well, it's ridiculous to think you could just follow your heart. If your heart tells you to eat lots and lots of ice cream, you know that it's not a good thing to follow your heart in this case. And so we, as scientists, this is something you can understand and appreciate, that your heart might be wrong. Your heart might be deluded and confused. A person who is wise and has a clear mind should follow their heart. The question is, how do we know whether we have a clear mind? How do we know that we're not acting out of partiality or delusion? So the idea that you should just follow your heart is incredibly naive, in that it assumes a correctness, it assumes a wisdom that may or may not be there. So we follow our experience. When you know, when you've observed something to cause you suffering repeatedly, then you follow that experience and you avoid that activity. When something leads you to happiness, to peace, you cultivate it. This actually comes naturally through this observation. You naturally change your habits and incline towards more beneficial habits and away from those that cause you suffering and cause suffering for others. It's not brainwashing. I'm not trying to tell you what is good and what is bad. Trying to provide the tools by which you can know for yourself, without a doubt, and without any external input whatsoever, you can know for yourself what is good and what is bad. At least in terms of the immediate peace of mind. It mimics science, material science, in that way, in the sense of providing an accelerated and controlled environment in which to observe reality. Because, of course, as you get older, you realize the value in experience. And the more experiences you have, the more data you have by which you can make informed decisions. So all we're doing here is speeding that up and controlling it, controlling the process. So we have a pure observation that allows us a heightened ability to understand and to learn about the nature of our minds. So that's all I have to say. We can continue meditating. But if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer them as well. If you don't, you can just keep your eyes closed and keep studying. But I'd like to answer questions if anyone has them, because it interferes with your practice. Obviously, if you don't understand or if you have problems with it, then it gets in the way. Yes, sir.
How can you make choices if you don't have desires, right? How can you choose if someone offered you juice or water? How would you base that decision if you didn't have a desire that you would choose better?
Yeah. I want to get a... scientifically there's still some desire, but in the mind there's a difference, because we're not rocks. If you think of the way the material world works, someone just asked this question recently we have this Stack Exchange site on the internet. They say, well, why do you do anything then if you have no desires? Well, but rocks don't do anything, that's clear. No, they don't do very much. But animals, organisms have a biological, imperative or need or whatever, that inclines them towards nourishment. So the claim I would make, which seems to be supported by experience, is that one sees the juice and says, oh, I need nourishment, and takes the nourishment. If one looks at the juice, like I've had juice this afternoon, so I'm actually not that inclined towards it. Mm-hmm. Right? And that may or may not be associated with desire. With an actual desire for the juice. There is actually a biological, I guess you call it biological, but just a natural inclination, because we naturally incline to do things. I mean, the basic question is, why do we do anything? So why not, why wouldn't, if you agree with the idea of organisms, human organisms, acting, just naturally acting, then well, why not take the juice? It's very much a part of the sphere of actions that one would expect from a human being. But desire is above that, is beyond that. You can do that without desire. That's the claim. It sounds, from a material scientist point of view, it sounds ridiculous. But if you watch, if you observe yourself, you can actually experience it. Where normally you'd have such desire for the juice, and that would lead you to take it. You can be free from that, and you can say, oh, right, yes, I need nourishment, and just take it. And you feel that there's something missing there, which is the desire for it.
But, desire can overpower even what you want, right? So if you already had juice, but you still desire it, even though you don't necessarily feel you want it,
you overpower it. Exactly. So this is the crux of the matter. We want to free ourselves from that, so that it is simply biological. It's a sense of wisdom. In fact, it gets to the point where like, well, okay, so I need the juice, but it's no big deal. Why should I take it? And you're like, well, I guess I'll take it. But if you don't get the juice, you're okay. If you don't get, and what I'm trying to say is, if you don't get food, if you wind up starving to death, so what? I mean, ideally, this is, and so now we talk about what Buddhist philosophy, and ideally, what does it matter? We're all going to die. And so you become much more open to your experience, to your reality. I mean, the point is, you become completely without expectations. So if you get the juice, you take it. If you don't get the juice, you do without it. Or food or anything. But simply, you get the point, you see, that your desire will overpower even if you don't want it. This is the problem that we have to overcome. And we say this is mental. On one level, so a person, suppose you've been addicted to juice your whole life, yeah, and Then you come and practice meditation and you free yourself from desire. And you're like, wow, I'm free from it. You will still have the brain, of course, telling you, get the juice. But you'll feel that. You'll feel the physical aspect of that, the brain going haywire. And you'll be like, oh, my brain is going haywire. Interesting.
All right, so you can observe that.
You will observe it.
An addiction or
yes, absolutely. You will feel awful in withdrawal from the juice, but it won't be awful, you see. There won't be that judgment of the experience as awful and think, well, I need to do something about this. It's very much a part of the addiction cycle is the need to escape the symptoms of withdrawal. I'm without it. And you react to that. So if you stop reacting to that and you just, you know, pain or stress, or whatever the suffering is, and you just see it as it is, you have no need for the juice whatsoever. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's called the substitution of opposites, and it works to an extent, but it doesn't create it. That won't teach you about your desire. You're substituting the opposite, the generosity, which is the opposite of clinginess. The same works with anger and love. So a Buddhist and Christian, I think, advice would be, if you hate someone, cultivate love for them. You know, actively pray for them, you would say, right? And this is a substitution of opposites. It works temporarily because you're activating another center in the brain that counters or whatever, you know, that counters the other emotion. But it will never disincline you from the other one. There'll always be the chance for you to cultivate the other one because you don't really understand why it's wrong to want things. All you have is a general sense that you've seen, oh yeah, look at that person who wants a lot and they're an awful person. Or you read the book and it says, covet not thy neighbor's wife, or you know, that kind of thing. And so someone else tells you. But you never have this visceral true understanding that we're looking for. If you can gain that, it's okay, but if you can gain the understanding that desire is not helping you, it's leading only to stress and suffering, then you don't ever have to do anything because you don't want to desire. You don't incline towards it. You think, why would I do that? It's a cause more stress and suffering. So, yes, it's very much recognized, but it's recognized as inferior to wisdom and understanding. That's no more questions? If not, we just meditate. We're here till 6:30, no? Or we leave early. I can't talk for 2 hours. I can, but I'd rather just meditate. Why don't we do... I'm going to sit here till 6 o'clock at least, so you've got 15 minutes to ask me more questions. Otherwise, we can start to... I can start to talk about... The other thing I'm supposed to include here is how to incorporate this into daily life, which should be fairly obvious because there's nothing unordinary about this. And that's a key distinction this sort of technique has between this technique and other meditations, is that it's very much involved with ordinary experience. It's not an escape. It's not a vacation. So there's no reason why you couldn't do this sitting in class, watching your emotions, watching your mind. And you can do this when you're having a conversation with people. In fact, if you get really good at it, you can do it while you're talking. You might find you talk less. But walking down the street, you can watch your feet moving, walking, walking, walking. when you're eating, you know, can chewing, swallowing. I mean, it's not like I'm saying this is how you should live your lives, by all means, if you want to, but it's a tool to cultivate objectivity. If you're a person who is addicted to certain types of food, it might be to your benefit to becoming mindful about the foods. It's definitely to your benefit. You'll see, in fact, most of us are addicted to many types of food, and once you start watching, you see how much stress and suffering there is in that, which you didn't even notice before. Until you started to watch, and you see, sure, eating is a really stressful endeavor. And eventually you get disinclined towards the attachment, the liking of the food or the disliking of the food, and you find it's much more peaceful. So all aspects of your life, when you apply this technique, the stress is reduced from the activity. And as a result, you'll suddenly find yourself days or weeks after you've begun the technique to be more at ease with yourself, less stress, less suffering. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter. See, the point is the state of mind of being objective. Now, our claim is that you can't do that normally. It's not a normal state. Normally, we're judgmental. So the word that we use, the reminder, where we say seeing, or in this case, emotions, liking, disliking, worry, fear, whatever, is just a way to straighten the mind out. And so that has an effect on the mind for straightening it out. So whichever one you pick doesn't really matter, but your mind will be straight during that time. The advice that we give, whichever one is clearest, whatever is clearest in your mind, and it doesn't really matter which one that is, pick that and be mindful of it. Because it's not a magic trick. It's not like a shooter game where you have to hit them all. Just keep your mind clear. And you'll see how your mind is working. Better anyway, it'll slowly clear up the mind. No, you should be at the front of the class. You're the keener. I like it. I notice nobody's sitting in the front, which means nobody's a real keener.
You mentioned about goals.
Yes. Yeah. I'm throwing that out there as like a bone, because really I don't encourage goals, but you have goals, and no. So we obviously should have high goals, spiritual, but in the sense of goals that truly bring us peace and happiness, and maybe even to the world bring peace and happiness. But we have those goals, and our less honorable goals can get in the way, like getting a pizza or cheesecake or watching a movie or things, bad ones like getting in a fight, arguing, stealing, cheating. All sorts of bad things can get in the way. Getting drunk, going out and getting drunk. Alcohol is something we totally shun, and scientists should shun completely. It's ridiculous that scientists will still drink alcohol. Your whole purpose in life is knowledge, and here you are destroying your mind. So not yet answering your question, but the most important is to cut off the lower goals, or the lower desires. Eventually, it's kind of like a wool sweater, where you see one thread loose, and you pull on it, and you say, I've got to get rid of that one. And so you pull on it. And the more you pull, the more you realize, oh, it's all, and then until it all unravels. So as you start to remove the coarse desires, you start to see, well, there's more refined things that are also causing me suffering. Until finally, in the end, you're free like a bird, and you've given up any sort of temporary goal. If you could say that you still have a goal, it would be just to be happy and find peace. Your goal is no longer to become rich or famous or whatever, even to save the world. You know, I'm going to save the environment. That's your goal. You can't save the environment. The earth is going to burn to a crisp in 2 billion years. Your goal of peace and happiness then informs all of your decisions. So if it's saving the environment, you do it because that's a part of peace. If Florida goes underwater, it's a problem for us. It's very difficult for us to cultivate wisdom, for example. So, but you wouldn't. Your goal wouldn't be saving the environment, for example, or whatever. Any of these things that are based on desire. So then, if you wanted to say that even desiring peace and happiness is a goal in itself, I think it's just semantics at that point, because your mind is just free, and you don't have any goal whatsoever. You're just inclined towards. You'd have no reason to cause stress and suffering. It's just more trouble than it's worth. I think in the end you can call it the path of least resistance. You really do end up following the path of least resistance. It doesn't look like it often, because an enlightened being would be helping people, would be doing good deeds. But they do it because not doing that leaves people in a state of chaos, and then you're surrounded by people in chaos. And in fact, so a person who helps others winds up being more at peace than a person who is selfish and worries only about their own happiness. It winds up being less happy because they're surrounded by miserable people who are also, greedy and selfish. Yes, sir. Sure.
I was not intending to ask questions before. Since you are from the Western world, you might have heard of some criticism leveled on Buddhism in terms of the passive religion. As an example, because Buddhism sometimes encourages or advocates passivity of getting rid of desires, especially in the Western world, it could be viewed as something towards non-development, development is today, globally.
Yep.
And as you know, as we all know, development is defined today based on Western standards and Western ambitions. Western people's ambitions have driven the scientific advancements and all these things.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes you might have heard of criticism.
Yes, I have.
In terms of being, as Buddhist being, encouraging passivity. So how do you, when you talk about getting rid of desire for the orange example that you were giving from time to time, if you get rid of ambition completely or desires completely, sometimes you might not be driven to achieve.
Mm-hmm. I think the main argument that I would stick by, it's quite a simple argument, it's just one single point. I think I would stand by it as true that human advancement, where it's necessary, has been spurred on the necessity has been artificially created by greed. And that's it. So overpopulation. If we didn't have desires anymore, I mean, let's not say have no desires, but if we didn't have so much desires, population wouldn't be exploding, I don't think. Now those countries that have come to a sense of a sort of, what do you call it, civility or advancement, they now have zero population growth. which is very important, because with huge population explosion, then you get disease and things that weren't there before. The desire for technology, I mean, just the, you know, these things are, they cause war in Africa as they try to mine all these metals. Our stressful jobs and lives, crime, all of these things are caused by our need for luxury, desires. You can live in, I've lived on a mat in the forest. I lived in a straw hut that cost probably $50 to build. I don't know exactly, very little, made of straw. And you can be very, very happy and at peace that way. And I'm sure, are you from Sri Lanka, sir? Yes, so I'm sure you've seen how some people live there quite little and still can be very happy. So I don't think it's a difficult argument. I think our understanding is just skewed. Because from a religious point of view, even the fact that we're human beings is something that has been cultivated. And I guess from a Western point of view, you'd say from evolution, it's all artificial. You know, the creation of humanity, it's all artificial. No, and then even more, once you get the Homo sapien, all that we've done since becoming Homo sapiens is incredibly artificial. There's nothing natural about it. So I guess there's no reason to see it. I'm getting at is the idea of you know, finding cures for diseases and so on. It's only solving a artificial problem, the problem of how to stay a human being. So ultimately, the universe has no problem with human beings dying. And from a Buddhist point of view, neither does the mind. So if you die from being a human being, it's not technically a loss. You know, you don't know where you're going next. From a Buddhist point of view, you're going to be reborn again. So if we talk about the advancements, they're still just an artificial in a specific context. There's no inherent benefit to human technological advancements that I can think of. I mean, there may be a few that we can discuss that might be difficult, but I'm willing to lay my money down on them being artificially constructed and of no real benefit over the long term in terms of solving the problem of the universe, the problem of existence. Curiosity? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Try to think, what is curiosity? Well, it's I don't think there's any benefit to it. Because you have to ask, where does curiosity come from? And this is what I'm trying to think of. I would say generally based on a sense of simple boredom, but also spurred by desire to have that aha moment where something new, where there's a new experience, something that excites you. So in the end, it's just a chemical addiction to something in the brain. Because you've experienced this. When you're curious, then you make new discoveries. How does it feel to make a new discovery? And that feeling that comes in the mind is stored. The brain says, yes, yes, that activity brought me this. So then later on, when you're bummed out, your brain says, hey, remember that curious thing? Let's do that again. That's how the addiction cycle works. Your brain keeps memories of the good and the bad. That's why you'll find that when you're sitting in meditation, your mind starts saying, hey, let's do this. Whatever you're, as I said, whatever you're inclined towards. Again, you get back to the idea that curiosity has spurred great creation, great somethings, you know, realizations and modern advancements. But again, the point being that those advancements haven't really solved the problem, haven't really done anything meaningful. The problems that they've solved have, I would say, been created by, have been artificially created. Sir?
Have to sort of compete with the others also, right? To some extent, in a realistic way. So they might have to be told that desire is, there are two types of desires that could have good consequences and bad consequences.
I understand that, but I don't think that comes back to whether you're a fundamentalist or not. Like, if you really, and I think it goes back to, it goes back to whether you're really dedicated to wisdom or whether you're content with deluding yourself. Are you content with deluding yourself into thinking, yes, me being a lawyer or a doctor or this or that has some inherent meaning in the universe? You know, me helping them build a rocket ship to the moon or to Mars or something, this is all, from our point of view, delusion. It's you're deluding yourself into thinking that somehow there is ultimate value in these things. Because ultimately there's no benefit in even the survival or in society. If you're dedicated to knowledge and understanding, then our claim is that through the practice of observation, of a scientific study of your own mind, you'll see that you gain nothing from desire of any sort. You don't actually become happier. That in fact, as difficult as it may seem to be, starving to death is more peaceful than desiring food, than going after food out of desire, for example. I mean, it's fundamentalist. And so again, I say it's in grades. Obviously, we're not expecting people to get that right away, but there's no need, because again, it's based on understanding. As long as you are dedicated to knowing the truth, not deluding yourself, and dedicated to being honest with yourself, step by step, you'll realize this for yourself. It's a claim that we make, and it's a very bold claim, and I think I'm happy to repeat it, because you can prove me wrong, step by step. Any step of the way you find out that clinging is good, clinging is bringing you true benefit. It doesn't really matter what I say at that point, because you're clinging to it. You've found that it's right. There's no way you're going to let go of that. You can't let go of something that you don't want to let go of. It's against nature. Our whole claim is that eventually you just want to let these things go. Yes, ma'am. again, you're looking at this from a point of view of religion. My claim is that eventually you'll understand. That eventually, as you study your own mind, you'll see that that's not the case. You'll see that the whole idea that we are social beings is just a belief. It's just a concept. It's artificial. There's no meaning in that. You know, it's a state that we find ourselves in. It doesn't say anything about whether it's the right state or a good state. It could be wrong. It could be that we're on the wrong track and we really shouldn't be social at all. I mean, it's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is you'll understand these things for yourself and you'll see that, you know, we're not talking about being selfish or being selfless. We're talking about understanding. Again, science. So it comes back to what we're dealing with here is the truth. Well, that's a good point. And again, it's not about controlling desires, it's about understanding them. I mean, if you could understand someone else's mind to the extent that you can understand yours, then you might have a point. I mean, I'd entertain it, but you can't. You can't do what you can do for yourself to someone else. You can't cultivate the same kind of understanding in someone else's mind as you do in your own. I mean, hopefully that, from my point of view, hopefully that's what I'm doing for all of you. But you see how far I've gotten. I've only scratched the surface. It's up to you whether you're going to do it for yourself. So, I mean, that's a very harsh argument. And I'm giving you the very hard argument, but it's not really fair what you're saying, because does it seem that I'm selfish coming here and teach? I mean, I'm obviously not an example of selfishness. I'm coming here to help you be what you would call selfish, so that you can go and help other people be what you would call selfish. But, you know, if we're all doing that, then where is the selfishness? We're admitting the fact that I can't do it for you. That's a very important Buddhist concept. I can't walk the path for you. I can't make you understand. And that's important, because we often believe that we can do that, right? We believe you can read someone's book and get understanding. You can't do that. Not ultimately. You can't really understand something. Otherwise, you'd read the Bible and you just follow it. But you can't, because the mind is not amenable until you change your mind. Well, people like to think that Buddhism teaches helping others, and I'm not saying it doesn't, but you have to be careful, because are you really going to help everyone? Absolutely not. And if you're not going to help everyone, then where's the science in it? The science is in being a helpful person. That's the best you can do. If you want to have a good stand, it can't be, I'm going to help everyone. It's ridiculous. You're deluding yourself. I'm going to even help this many people. Well, that's arbitrary. How can you, you know, what's to say? The only stand you could honestly take would be to be a helpful person. And so as you say, yes, obviously worth mentioning that when your mind is pure, when you don't have your own desires, that's another thing I would say, is that obviously you say it's self-centered or selfish. Well, you know, isn't the person who still has all the desires far more selfish? Isn't what we're talking about getting rid of all of that in your mind? I mean, what makes a person worry only about themselves? Well, stinginess, their own greed. Because I could share this with all of you, but I never thought of it because I wanted it for myself. To the point where I wouldn't even give it to someone who was starving because I want it. But when you get rid of that, you remove all of this which keeps us from being social creatures, to use your word. I don't think yourself, I mean, it's a word you're using, but I think in a pejorative sense.
No, I'm not thinking pejorative, because, I mean, Christianity itself is also self-centered. It's also
Right.
You have to help yourself before you actually help the neighbor.
Right.
You cannot help somebody before you help yourself.
Yeah.
So it requires work on you before you.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, if that's all you mean, then yeah. But your question was? Yeah. Right, but the question is whether it's worth it, whether what I'm saying is true, that it's scientific, that you can learn, and that do we want to learn the truth, or do we just want to believe what we've been taught?
But then, if it takes us so long, it's almost...
It's better to delude ourselves?
No, it's like you're isolating yourself. That's what I want. I mean, you don't get...
Uh-huh. Well, it's a very artificial, it's very, you know, it's only because you don't have any clue how it actually works that you're saying that. Because, well, I mean, again, going back to what I was saying is that you can do this walking down the street. You can do this communicating with people. You know, instead of getting an argument, instead of two people yelling at each other, you have your mind is calm, is unmoved. So society works better. Is more, you know, it's a part of your practice to help others, to interact with others, to be in the world. You know, I think maybe you're coming into this with some ideas about like Buddhism or so on. Right. Because all I'm talking about is being objective. No, non-subjectivity. I'm not talking about isolating yourself or any such thing. And you know, all I've been saying is be objective, because partiality causes suffering for you and others. That's it. That's all I wanted to say today. And point out how it's based on science. It's based on knowledge. It's not based on escapism or running away from your problems.
Peacefully starving, I guess. So then you just starve to death. What's the point, right? You no longer have that peace because you're dead.
Right. Well, then you get into the idea of whether death exists. Does death exist?
I don't know.
I don't know. If death exists, then yes. But okay, take for the sake of argument, suppose death exists. At death, there's nothing. Then what's the point of anything? What's the point of not doing that?
I guess to be happy.
What's the point? Okay, well, you've got something there, but I still say you'd take the path of least resistance to get there. So you think, why would I stress myself out over getting food? And you'd still come. Most people wouldn't have enough time in one lifetime to get there, but if you could, if you really were intent on this and you dedicated your life to it, you'd come to the realization that the most peaceful is to just let yourself starve to death. I mean, most people don't do that because there's food everywhere, and there's always, you're in a society where there's food available. I mean, even monks, we...
So you're saying you can give up the desire to live?
Yeah. I mean, why would you desire to live? You'd have to find... I mean, you see, there's... We have to be. We're science. As I assume you people are at least in some way scientists, or well, maybe not. But I am a scientist. I consider myself as a Buddhist to be a scientist in the sense of wanting to be honest, not delude myself, and not just believe something because that's what sounds right to me, but to actually get to the truth of the matter, because I might be completely wrong. My idea of things might be actually causing me suffering. Might be hurting others as well. So we have this claim that even the desire to live, you know, because then obviously what happens when you die? Do you feel happy? No, you're suffering. I want to live. And it sounds awful. You think you give up the desire to live because that's what we're taught. We're taught, live your life. You only live once and all these things. Well, they have the desire to die.
Desire to
which can most times be worse, because they're full of hatred for their life, hatred for themselves. From a Buddhist point of view, if you die like that, you're not going to a good place. How are we doing? 6:15. Thank you. This has been a nice time. You don't have to be convinced. No, you don't have to be convinced at all. You have to study the truth. If you find out that the truth is different from what I'm saying, then don't listen to me.
Actually, I think Buddhism has given enough of study for this. If you realize that Buddhism gives enough examples to be in a position to help other people by just understanding yourself, and that doesn't have a time factor like this lady.
Well, no, that's something I didn't say, is that actually it'll take a month. If you take a month, if you give me a month of your life, I can change it. No problem. Don't worry about lives. Sorry, go ahead.
As you mentioned initially in your talk, by understanding the reality of things, needs and things like that, that probably rids you of unnecessary desires and makes a label. Lives in society with other people, all kinds of other people, to be in a very good position to become a role model in society without having to give up everything.
Absolutely. It's just, philosophically, we always get these questions because people say, well, what if everyone became a monk? Then there'd be no sex and no reproduction. Because we always go to the extreme. So if you go to the extreme, I have to give you the extreme answer, because I have to say, well, who cares if there's no human beings? I mean, does it really mean anything? But from a practical point of view, you can't hear that, because it's like, no, it's not where we're at. So definitely, your answer is much more comfortable and much more realistic. Let's get rid of the things that we can all agree are a problem in this world. That's really all we're asking. But from a point of view of the philosophy and academically, it really does mean letting go of everything. But the point is, you will find that you help yourself and you help others in that way. It doesn't do any of the scary things that you think. If it did, you'd just stop, because it's all about what you want to give up. You see, you're clinging to it. When you cling to it, I can't. You don't let go. It's the opposite of what we're taught. You hold on to that.
What about the saying, ignorance is bliss? I like holding on to these things.
What about the saying, you only live once? It's just a saying.
Like, you could be ignorant and just be completely happy.
Yeah.
Like a dog.
Could you?
Very intelligent, they're just happy.
Are they?
They can eat their food, they wag their tail, it's a good life.
It's a short life. It's a life full of suffering. You ever seen old dogs when they're, you've seen dogs biting each other's faces off? I don't know. Is a dog's life happy? It's short. Yeah, a dog's life is somehow privileged, but it's very, very artificial. It's very, very short. I'd go there. I'd say, okay, dog's life, some sort of bliss in some cases. But have you ever, if you've ever, I get a lot of students who have dogs and come to me with problems about their dogs. And I've just started telling people, don't have a pet, because it's horrible. The pet gets old, what do? Spend thousands of dollars trying to keep it in this torturous existence until finally, usually, they have it, they kill it. It's like some kind of robot that we can just turn on, and when we're through with it, we turn it off and throw it away. So certainly not utopic bliss. But the part of it that is, fine. I mean, it's there. It's just, it doesn't mean that I'd want to be born a dog by any means. It's not something that I would find fulfilling, and to be pampered like that and so on. Because it doesn't last forever. It doesn't last very long at all.
But then if you just don't know, right, if you fill yourself with the artificial world.
If you could live in that enjoyment in perpetuity, then absolutely, but you can't. So, okay, you got that time as a dog. It was surrounded by the birth and the death, and then that's it, you know. It's you're getting into kind of philosophical issues of rebirth. And, you know, so we apply cause and effect beyond death. You can watch how your mind works. There's a causality and there's an orderliness to the nature of the mind here. The Buddhist claim is that continues, that death is just a concept. It's, you look at someone, you see they died, but from the point of view of the person, it continues on. And so happiness doesn't lead to happiness. The dog that's happy their whole life, that doesn't in any sense mean that they're going to be happy in the next life. We would consider that if a dog lives a happy life, it's because of some cause for the happiness, some purity of mind. So generally we'd suggest that probably humans become dogs and dogs become, it's kind of a, you know, it could be one of your relatives in a past life kind of thing, because they tend to have human characteristics, especially purebreds and that kind of thing. It's a highly cultivated artificial sort of existence. You know, maybe they were the caretaker in the family and now everyone has to take care of them, and so that's why they're pampered. But the main point is that we make is that goodness leads to happiness. So if you want to be happy, you have to be a good person. You have to have a pure mind and be cultivating wholesomeness in the mind, purity in the mind, clarity in the mind. So a dog's life is probably leading up to a next life that's not so good. It means they're on a path that's full of delusion, and they do lots of... It depends. Some dogs can become humans after, because their minds are so pure. So it's bigger than that. It's the long term. And you have to ask yourself universally, what leads to peace, what leads to happiness? My claim is it's wisdom and understanding.
Well, so now maybe this is kind of an overview question. So you then have the desire to achieve this understanding, right? Isn't that itself a desire? A desire to relieve yourself from a desire?
It's possible to have that desire, but that desire will actually lead to suffering, because when you don't get it, when you don't get what you want. No.
Is that what you're saying?
No, you shouldn't be. But you should be honest with yourself. You say to yourself, I want to be happy, and yet you do things that cause yourself suffering. That's a sort of incongruity, you know, that you have a stress that you have. So, and then the Buddha would say, you know, that's just going to lead you to suffering. So he wouldn't say, don't do that. He would just say, point out that it leads to suffering. And that knowledge in your mind inclines you to get rid of it.
Well, what I'm saying is that I have a desire to understand what you're saying, right?
Yeah.
And that itself is a desire, but to understand what you're saying is to relieve yourself of desires. So it's kind of a circular logic.
Except for what I'm saying is the intention, because I've planted an intention in your mind that I think you can say is not desire. And some people will say there are good desires and there are bad desires. I want to kind of get away from that, and I want to be kind of clearer than that. There's an intention that I've planted in your mind. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what happens when someone suggests something. If I tell you that I've got this potion that's going to cure all your problems, then you cultivate an inclination. You say, oh. And you at least create the mental activity in your mind to think about it, to process the statement. And so it's not necessarily desire to understand. It's the response. What I'm saying has entered your mind and you've started to consider it. The desire comes afterwards, if there's desire. It doesn't have to. So ideally, it's given you knowledge and it helped you say, oh, maybe this is the way, and incline in that way. And so maybe when you leave here, you'll try this. You'll watch your stomach and you'll actually do some meditation, that kind of thing. That's all. Doesn't have to have desire. That being said, most of us do it based on desire. Why do you come here? It's, I want to meditate and I want to feel peace and calm and so on. No, you have this desire. Eventually you realize, oh, that's just causing me suffering, and you let it go, and then you really find peace. And
yeah, sure. You know, I did meditation for health reasons. I desire to be healthy.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily the goal of it.
Yeah, and obsession with
doing it,
like obsession with health is eventually going to cause you suffering. That's the point. You know, why we come to meditate, many different reasons. Even why you ordain as a monk, many different reasons. But the point still stands that desire only leads you to stress. So it's a claim. You can see for yourself or not. Yes, ma'am, sorry. You were what? No, no, please. I could stay all night.
I have just a curiosity. So, we're not born with this ability of actually training our minds to actually be objective. So, we're born with feelings and emotions, like the natural reaction of our brain.
Be careful of the word natural. Well, okay, go ahead. Sorry. Again, you're using words.
And now...
You're making claims, you see. It's okay, go ahead. I'm teasing.
And then, you go through this, you're actually tricking your mind. You're altering your reality.
Tricking your mind?
No, training.
Training your mind, okay.
Training.
Yeah.
You're altering your reality.
Yes, ma'am.
So you have a reality where it's created by all these neurotransmitters involved with the feelings and emotions and stuff.
Right. Yeah.
And we're the third type of mind that would tell you that this is kind of a bit better, and this is a bit worse. The third type of state of mind and reality that would tell you, you need a reference frame. That's what I'm saying.
I see. And you don't think it's enough that you observe that something's causing you suffering? Are you sure?
I'm sure.
And what do you base that on?
Because
I know it's wrong. That's my belief. So.
Well, as you said, it's your belief.
Yeah. Well, it's my claim.
Okay. So, and I can claim that.
Absolutely. It's just your prerogative.
Yeah. So, what I'm
but we can investigate these claims. And so you could try my meditation and investigate. And if you found out that I'm full of gunk,
I'm
then...
I'm just not saying that we're biological beings. We like it or not. Everything that happens in ourselves, it's a matter of probability.
Okay.
So
it's a matter of probability. So you believe in determinism?
I don't believe in it.
Okay. So then how is it a matter of probability? So you mean like stochastic or random?
It's not random.
Well, that's what stochastic means.
Well, what I'm saying is that stochastic, yeah, but you can, Monte Carlo is stochastic, and you can still buy to get data.
Okay, I'll believe you on that one. I'll take your word for it. I'm not a scientist.
I'm sorry, but
that's okay.
Using the scientific term.
No, no. Yeah, but your premise is that it's stochastic, and I don't see where you're coming from with that. I mean, how do you back that claim up? Okay, let's say that our our state of mind is random.
No, that the basis of processes that go on the cellular level.
Right, but not, okay, cellular level, but not mental level we're talking. Because I'm talking about the mind.
Yes, but mind is just an emerging.
As an emergent property of the brain? Well, now you've got a problem. Have you ever heard of the hard problem? The hard problem of consciousness? How does the mind emerge from the brain? That's the hard problem. Because no one has an answer. Anyone who says they do is lying to you.
Yeah.
I can prove it, I'm conscious. That's the hard problem. That's right, you can't attach it to something. So to say that it's an emergent property of the brain is a total faith-based claim. I don't even know that this room exists. I don't know that you exist. I don't know that I'm not a brain in a vat. What I do know is that there's seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking. I don't know what those are, but I know that they exist. So if you tell me consciousness doesn't exist,
no, I'm not saying that.
I know, but... Right, oh no, sorry. So the question of separating is, for me it's not a matter of separating, it's about sticking to what I know. That's what Buddhism really does, is it sticks to what we know, so reality, it's a paradigm shift. It's no longer based on a three-dimensional, four-dimensional reality. It's now based on a six-dimensional, the six senses. Experience, experiential. They tried to make a science out of it, phenomenology, radical phenomenology, where your basis point is the senses, and you try to, but you can't get very far with it. That's the problem. You can't go much further than that. You can't then connect it with quantum physics, I guess. Although quantum physics actually seems to imply that, or leave room anyway for the existence of consciousness, for the efficacy of consciousness. Depending who you ask. Did I do anything to help there? Sorry. Yeah, but maybe you're also being intellectual instead of just, you know, you are conscious. I'm assuming you'll tell me, I don't know that you are or not, but I'm assuming you'll tell me that you're conscious. And that's the reference point that we're starting from. Are you?
To meditation as a layman, as a normal person.
Is that what she's asking?
In a different way, but as a non-regular person.
It just, for me, I am concerned what it can do to my way of thinking.
Okay.
Going to it.
Great.
That's why I need a third reference frame that would tell me objectively, okay, so this would affect your brain in this way.
Yeah, we don't have that. You just have to, because there's no one there but you. So you just have to, you have to do that anyway. You see, you have to make decisions, no matter what science or anyone tells you, you still have to make decisions, right? You still have to decide how you're going to live your life. Am I going to follow this or follow that?
Yes, but I'm going to do a decision based on something that I already know, and based on something that I don't know at all. Because as I said, it's a kind of individual.
Okay. So you're going to choose something just because you already know it?
Well, that would be the logical.
Why? Could be wrong. What you're doing, what you already know could be wrong.
Yeah, but there's no way for me to test.
But there is a way for you to test.
No, without me actually getting involved and being altered, because once I'm going to go into it, I will
that's a good point.
Alter my mind, so yeah. Biased.
Yeah, I get it. But that's only... No. I get what you're saying, but you're thinking in terms of a material science point of view of the frame of reference of multiple consciousnesses, and that only works in the physical realm. In consciousness, you only have your own experience, and so you don't have that. You don't have the ability. All you have is happiness and suffering. You have a knowledge that something brings you happiness and something brings you suffering. You don't really need the paradigm that you're thinking of, is what I'm trying to say. The truth is that you can see for yourself whether something leads you to peace and or leads you to... I mean, think of the mind in terms of becoming more chaotic or becoming more peaceful. I mean, it's very simple, objectively realizable states where you can watch how something makes your mind chaotic or anxious or angry or addicted. You can watch this occurring. And you can see how it ceases. And so what you're thinking of is actually not the state, it's not the case. It's only what science has taught you, has told you. I mean, as I understand, this is the sort of argument that you get from people who are used to material scientists, the scientific method. But the truth is you can watch your mind and you can be objective and you do become happier and more at peace with yourself. There's not a bias. I mean, the only way to know whether there is a bias or not would be to try it. You know, you've been told, or you've been given reasons why it would be the case that you'd be biased because you're the biased observer. This is why science is dedicated to not taking the word of a single observer. I mean, do what you want is what I would say to such a person, but by committing yourself to that, you're taking away any opportunity for self-growth. I think you have to admit that. In any way, any sort of self-growth. By committing yourself to the idea that you need a third objective party. By saying that it's not possible to be objective, you're therefore not. You're closing the door on any potential self-realization, and you'll always be dependent on external influence. So someone else telling you what's right and wrong, basically. There'll always be an external force telling that you can't verify, telling you what's right and wrong for you. So. As opposed to actually testing and learning for yourself what's right and wrong, what brings you peace and happiness and what creates stress in the mind. You can't do that. You rely on something external, which, how do you know that it's true? How do you know that it's the right way? I mean, there's no means of discerning that. I suppose what we could do to settle this sort of a debate is run studies. Take groups of people that choose either way and figure out which one had less stress, for example. And they've done that. And there's the NIH has a web page on dedicated to meditation and the benefits of this sort of meditation on stress. There's a difference? All right. Well, right, so if a person has lots of stress and a person has little stress, you wouldn't say one is happier than the other? Has nothing to do with stress? Yeah, so I wouldn't call it, I would say it's not happiness then, if it's causing you stress. I mean, and it's, these are just words. We're talking about like people who are able to reduce their worrying in life, for example, their suffering. Of course, you know, finding an objective measure of suffering is difficult, but there are some pretty broad, I mean, you're making some pretty tough arguments here that I don't think you need to make because it's quite a simple process. You try it, you become happier. I mean, this is not rocket science. It really does work, and there's studies to show it. I mean, we could have philosophical arguments about the nature of happiness, but it's really pretty simple. You know, there's people killing themselves, you know, committing suicide out there over these things. You practice meditation, you can free yourself. I used to be an insomniac. I was up till 3 a.m. I can cure people of insomnia in about a week now. For life. Cure them in about a week, less than a week, even one day in some cases. And people kill themselves over insomnia. They take sleeping pills. So I can cure that. It's very simple. No, it's nice to... Well, I hope it's helped. Well, I hope you try it. Let me know how it goes.
Study groups was a group of Cambodian monks, and they studied several different sets of people, individuals, and they concluded that the group of Cambodian monks was the happiest or after a neural study that you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, but what does it mean? It means that maybe people in Cambodia are happier, or not easy. I mean, I know these studies of monks being happy, but, you know, what does it mean? And again, I think you'd have to even go deeper and say, what does happiness mean? Because people can be very, very happy for no reason at all. Very, very content or at peace for no reason at all. So we're actually trying to go beyond that, and we want to be more scientific than that. And again, Buddhism, the full disclaimer, full disclosure, we believe in rebirth, that we're, you know, from life to life to life, it's infinite. So that kind of happiness could be temporary. Why I'm saying this in this case is monks who practice samatha meditation can exhibit extreme perfection of peace, but it's temporary because it's not based on wisdom. So it's not going to last, right? They go to Brahma realms, they whatever. I mean, this kind of, to talk about this in a scientific form, is we have to go quite deeper and probably do a lot more experimentation to talk about things like rebirth and so on. But I think you'd have to, I think this is why they do studies with test groups. They'll take two groups of people who all want to come to do a meditation-based, a mindfulness-based meditation. Half of them, they all want to, and it's random. Half of them, they say, you wait for 2 weeks. The other half, they put through a 2-week meditation course. And just 2 weeks of basic meditation has clear results, benefits. So, I mean, whether that makes you ultimately happy is obviously up for debate. Some people would say if you don't have X belief, then you can never be truly happy. And, you know, there's different measures of happiness. So take it for what it is. If you think, well, all this is going to do is reduce my stress, then fine. I mean, my job is done. You'll have less stress. It's practical. But I also wanted to emphasize that it's based on understanding. That's something that a lot of people don't get about Buddhism or meditation. And so they think it's all about escapism or transcending your problems. It's actually all about learning and understanding your problems and the causes of your problems. It's the claim. Okay, 7:15, I think some people are shifting in their seats. Thank you all for coming. I wish you all to find peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering.